That's the title track from Michael Card's album, The Hidden Face of God. It's a collection of laments, and it's just a sterling example of Christian songwriting. Michael Card and The Hidden Face of God. 13 minutes after the hour, it's a Wednesday morning. We welcome Doug Greenwald to the studios. Actually, he's not in the studios. I don't want to mislead anybody. Actually, Doug is at the base of operation for Preserving Bible Times, which is in Columbia, Maryland, which is just on the outskirts of Washington, D.C., where there's a lot of activity and powerful people and a lot of decisions being made, a lot of reporters crowding around people seeking answers and interviews. And what's life like in that hot spot, Doug?
I heard it's humid there, too.
Yeah, probably.
It isn't humid yet, but, you know, in the summer it certainly is. The place is built on a swamp, and there may be some symbolism to that after a while.
Well, is that why they call it old Foggy Bottom, referring to the State Department?
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, there was a fascinating article in the Washington Post two, three, 4 days ago. You know, it came from one of these think tank kind of things. Two authors wrote it. And here's the thesis. You know, people are decrying the dysfunctionalism of Washington, D.C., the gridlock of Washington, D.C., and their overall thesis was, it's democracy at work. What you're seeing in gridlock is perfect representative government. Mm-hmm. You know, and that sort of gets your attention. And then they start going down into the weeds and pointing out the demographic trends. It said, what's happening in the politics in the United States is it's becoming balkanized. It's becoming segmented. It's a black and white kind of a deal. If you're a Republican, you see things one way. And if you're a Democrat, you see things another way. And mostly in the city areas are where the Democrats have influence. And out in the regional areas is where the Republicans have influence. And they're each electing people to represent their viewpoints. And those people are going to Washington, D.C. and are very nicely and in the viewpoints of their respective constituencies, which is whatever you do, don't cooperate with the Democrats. And the Democrats' viewpoint is whatever you do, don't cooperate with the Republicans. And so both sides are perfectly representing the sides of their populace. That's what they want them to do. That's what they were elected to do. Democracy is working perfectly. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting perspective.
That article was written partly by Dan Balls.
No, this wasn't not Dan. The one? It was from, you know, I don't know, it was the Heritage Foundation or one of those think tanks. But they went on to say that increasingly the House of the Representatives is always going to be red. Mm-hmm. Increasingly with this trend, the presidency is always going to be blue. And increasingly modestly in this trending direction is the Senate is going to be mostly red. And so get ready for it, people. It's going to be red against blue, White House against Congress for a long, long time as representative democracy continues to work perfectly. People are being represented for exactly the positions they want their elected people to represent. So it's kind of an interesting viewpoint when people lament the gridlock, the dysfunctionality of Washington, D.C., that's what the vast majority of people want, by the way. They elect and send their particular representatives to Washington with their assignments of what they want them to do.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I would suggest that they don't want people to do something. They want them to not do something and to stop the other side from doing whatever they're doing. So I've always said that the less done in a legislature, the better off the people are. Go ahead.
I think that those two thoughts fit. The doing means stopping.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, so what does this mean for current events? Well, let's take Hillary's new controversy with her foundation and influence peddling, allegedly, et cetera, et cetera. Here's my prediction. There will never be found any explicit smoking gun evidence that will allow people to connect those dots, okay? Mm-hmm. But there will be a ton of implicit data that strongly suggests it.
Sure.
And therefore, Obama's Department of Justice won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. And because the country is balkanized into black and white perspectives, there really aren't independents much left anymore. There is no middle ground. The people who are going to vote blue are going to continue to vote blue, and the people who are going to vote red are going to continue to vote red. And per that article, each side wants their representatives to perfectly represent that perspective. So that's my prediction.
Mm-hmm. Well, and she'll be the next president.
That I don't know. But, you know, what they were saying is it's almost to the point where issues don't matter much anymore either. You're going to, you know, even if Attila the Hun is the nominee for a certain party, everybody's going to vote for him or her anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I see your point.
I read an article, Maureen Dowd's article over the weekend on Hillary's latest peccadillo. And it was before the book came out, but it was something else that she was written, and it was a fairly well written article. And it was anti Hillary, and Maureen is usually not that way. She likes the Hill, and but the most interesting part of the article was the feedback afterwards, and it was clear, black and white, up and down. Hillary is a wonderful person. I love the way she wears her pantsuits, and her cankles are just the right size, and therefore I'm going to vote for her for president. And the next letter would be, who does this woman think she is? She's out breaking laws left and right. I'll vote for anybody but her. And it was clearly drawn right down the middle.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that crystallized in my mind, I'd never really thought about that. We keep talking about the independents, the people in the middle who need to be persuaded. There aren't many of those left anymore.
No.
That's a rare and extinct species.
Yeah. Well, it's long been said, we get what we vote for. And Washington's a reflection of who we are and what we think. And we are in two different camps across the country. So,
well, yeah. I would question the last word, think. I don't know that the electorate thinks all that often.
Well, that's another issue. Yeah.
And I think I've told you the story about last year's class reunion. An old classmate came up to me and she said, "Well, Dave, you know all about politics." I said, "Well, sure, if you say so." And she wanted advice on who to vote for in an upcoming race. And I gave her the 2-minute answer, the dripping with patriotism and red, white, and blue, and the best for the country, and all the rest of that stuff. Now, I said, but if you want the short answer, look for the guy with the nicest hair. And she looked at me and she says, I think I'll do that.
People take
that
too
reminds me of P.T. Barnum, who long ago said, "You'll never go broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public."
Oh, yeah.
And I think both the Democratic and Republican parties have sort of adopted that mantra.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so.
Well,
yeah. If you look at the emails that I get from both sides, yeah, they think I'm the dumbest thing that's ever crawled out from under a rock. Yeah.
Doug, last week we started on a journey out of Luke 8, if anybody wants to follow along, and we set the stage, or you set the stage just beautifully for us. We want to kind of pick up where we left off here. And as I recall, we were in what you had termed a supernatural storm on Lake Galilee. It had been a long day of work, of teaching and learning and doing as Jesus was wont to do on the Northwest Shore. And at the end of that day, when everybody figured they could go home and kick back for a while, he said, "Get in the boat."
We're going to the other side.
The other side. And what fascinates me is we read that just like it's plain English here, and you've identified those words, "the other side," as code words, that they actually were substitutes for a word they couldn't say. They couldn't say Decapolis or the Gerasenes or any of those. It was forbidden territory for them, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It's the land of evil. Satan is viewed as the chief operating officer of the Decapolis. It's the worldview of hedonism. Everything that goes on in the Decapolis is forbidden to an observant Jew. If there's one thing any Jew knows, is you not ever set foot on land in the Decapolis. And so when Jesus says, "Get in the boats," and it's "get in the boats now," there's another code phrase in Mark 4, the same passage. where it says, and they took him just as he was. That means now, not even as soon as possible, but now. Get in the boats. We're going to the other side. These guys were in shock.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Decapolis is in the kind of the southeastern quarter, or at 4 and 5 o'clock, if you look at a clock with north at the top or 12 o'clock at top, and you picture the Sea of Galilee. So this is in the southeast shore of the lake. And that's an area that really had been determined. Its character determined by Alexander the Great. Isn't that true?
Well, Alexander the Great brought in Macedonian city-states as part of his subjugation strategy back around 300 BC. Actually, from probably 320 to 300. And this is what's left of many city-states that he imported. There are 10 of them left. They're in a loose confederation called the Decapolis. They're all pretty sizable cities of 15 to 25,000 people. And I think one of the things that we Western evangelical Christians miss, because we really don't do our geography and social political research very, very well, is there's far more Gentiles in the Galilee region than there are Jews. Mm. That's sort of surprising to us, I think, but that's actually what's going on here. But in Luke's record, through the first 7.5 chapters, Jesus is in the relatively friendly confines of the northwest quadrant of the Sea of Galilee, where observant Judaism has a strong hold. And this is the first time now that he's going to go on the offensive into enemy territory, leaving the friendly confines of northwest Sea of Galilee, observant Judaism, and going to the Decapolis. And that is not lost on his disciples. They know that they have never left the friendly confines of observant Judaism. They know they're going where they're not supposed to go. They know that's where Satan is the chief operating officer, and they expect resistance. They expect a fight. They expect a showdown at the OK Corral. That's part of the shock that's going on here with these guys. And when that storm comes up in nighttime, as they see across the Sea of Galilee, they see it as a demonic wind. Satan has no problem hijacking nature for his nefarious causes. And then, as we know in our contemporary world, trying to point to God as the reason that tsunamis take place and hurricanes take place and all that sort of thing. And so these disciples get in a boat. They are not happy campers, and then they get caught in this violent storm. They're convinced they're about to die, and they wake Jesus up, and he immediately, I mean, in a nanosecond, stills the winds and calms the waves. And I'm always fascinated by calms the waves, because once waves get set in motion, and these are 5 and 6 foot waves, by the way, mm-hmm. They have to go all the way to shore before they dissipate themselves. And so miracle number one in this story is simply that a raging sea suddenly becomes dead flat. And that now creates a new problem. How are we going to get to the other side to complete our journey if we have no wind? And that's when I think Jesus says, okay, guys, grab the oars and start rowing. And that's about where we pick up our story.
Yeah. I have a question for you, though. You mentioned the satanic storms and Satan's influence in the Decapolis. What was the Jewish view of Satan, and when did that develop? Because I don't think he's mentioned in the Old Testament. Now, these disciples would have known their scriptures, meaning the Jewish old, you know, the Pentateuch, and maybe the Psalms and the prophets. Where did they get their concept of Satan?
Well, they would have gotten it from Isaiah for sure, where mm-hmm. Lucifer, mm-hmm. the fallen angel, is described, God's adversary. So they're very aware that God has an adversary. Mm-hmm. Remember, these guys from ages 5 to ages 13 memorized most, if not all, of their Old Testament scriptures. Any reference to Lucifer, any reference to God's adversary, they know it. They know their scriptures cold, and that's the perspective that they have. They know they're doing something that they're not supposed to do. They expect resistance, and by Jove, here it comes. Mm. So they start rowing. I'm guessing now it's about 11 o'clock at night. I don't know how much ambient moonlight there is. But as they row, if you look at the map, they're sailing southeast. And by and large, now they have their backs to the shore. So they stroke and row and stroke and row. And as they get closer to the shore, they begin to hear screams. Sound travels well over water, as you Maryland or Minnesota people know.
We discovered that, yes.
And they start to hear screeches and screams and shrieks faintly. And then they grow louder and louder as the boat gets closer to the shore. And at some point, they conclude that is a demon-possessed something, which doesn't surprise them. In the land of Satan, there's a lot of demon possession. In the lands that surround Israel, it wouldn't be unusual to dedicate your firstborn to the devil, kind of like the Italian immigrants did a couple hundred years ago when they would dedicate their firstborn son to the Catholic Church to be a priest. Mm. So demonic possession is not unusual in the nations that surround Israel. You can go to the British Museum, you can see demonic masks from the first century period to get a better feel for that. And as they keep rowing and the screeches and the screams get louder, there's a point where one of them turns around and sees the profile of a man, or what seems to be a person. And then they get a little bit closer and they realize, whoops, this person is bare naked. If you're an observant Jew, you are forbidden from observing any nakedness of another man, or a woman for that matter. But even, let's keep it to a man, even if it's their ankles and the lower part of their legs. That's what was so provocative about the father in the Good Samaritan story, is he lifted up his outer garment and began to run to greet his son. Mm-hmm. And in there, so doing, was burying the bottom part of his legs, which is an absolute no-no in that culture. So, okay, we're forbidden to set foot on Gentile land. We're forbidden to observe a naked person or any part of that person's nakedness. And as they continue to get closer and closer to the shore, they begin to see the profile of caves in the background. I actually have a picture of this site during the day. There are a number of pockmarked caves in the downslope of this geological formation near the water. And they think, uh-oh, those are tombs. And that's another thing observant Jews are forbidden to do, to get too close to tombs. I want you to get the feeling here that these guys are on a journey that they didn't want to take, and the unclean issues continue to accumulate, continue to pile up. In fact, it's getting so bad here, when you read Luke's narrative, it's really fascinating. It says they got to the shore, and only Jesus got out of the boat. I think we miss that in our readings in Western evangelicalism. But it doesn't say they all got out of the boat. It doesn't say Jesus and some of the disciples got out of the boat. It simply says he got out of the boat. This thing is so messy. This thing is so full of ritual purification violations that if they do get out of the boat and observe this guy and set foot on Gentile ground, they might be in the ritual purification baths for a month. Mm.
Now this is Jesus doing and teaching again, isn't it? You've made that clear. He is dealing with the old paradigm.
How do you remake people who have an entrenched paradigm about what they think is right? The answer is you don't give them lectures. You don't do a retreat weekend. You don't offer a 3-sermon series. You immerse them in something that is so profoundly different from anything that they've ever experienced, it forces their paradigms to be wrenched, cracked, and then ultimately the objective here is to destroy them. Hmm. And so this is Jesus's pedagogy. We really see it most clearly in Luke because he writes from a chronological perspective. Jesus immerses these guys in one shock therapy experience after another, and only later does he start to do his teaching and explain some of what's going on. And that's another perspective on how Jesus makes disciples. He detoxes them, sometimes radically, sometimes with a profound experience that just overwhelms them. as he starts this process of taking away from them everything that observant Judaism taught them was right and true, so that they can be freed up to see and then understand and then ultimately embrace and fall in love with his kingdom of God. And so one observation here is a lot of our, I'm going to use a word I don't normally use here, but a lot of our discipleship practices in Western evangelicalism today are far too gentle. All we do is teach people. We give them lectures. We give them sermons. We go to classes. But seldom do we get put in paradigm-wrenching experiences like Jesus puts his disciples through day after day after day to speed up the process by which he detoxes them and gets them ready to fall in love with his kingdom.
Hmm. I guess I would say that maybe President Obama is giving us too much gradual immersion in the nasty future we can expect. But if it was sudden, we would suddenly wake up, snap our eyes open, and realize what was going on.
Yeah, that, you know, I don't know whether Obama's trying to detox Republicans from this, that, or the other thing, but I do know what Jesus was trying to accomplish here.
Yeah. This seems like much more effective.
Ultimately, he got an awful lot done in 3 years that if the only thing he ever did was teach and give lectures, it might have taken him 30.
Hmm. Well, we do see the change in the disciples, ultimately. They from simple fishermen and blue-collar types, they became leaders of a new phenomenon in the world and dedicated the rest of their lives to it. So
yes, Jesus, thanks to the infusion of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost.
Yes, that's what it took, finally.
Tied all of these experiences together and knit them into a unified whole. Mm-hmm. But that's one perspective we have to have on how Jesus makes disciples. It's not tiptoe through the tulips with Jesus most days. Mm-hmm. Jesus is out to challenge every paradigm we've ever had that our culture has given us, and even our religious culture. So issues of what constitutes success and importance and status and prestige, Jesus is going to say, that stuff has got to go. That is not how my kingdom operates. And, you know, for some, like, it's hard to give up those sort of accoutrements of our culture when we come into the kingdom of God. And that's part of what needs to take place in remaking converts into disciples of Jesus.
Well, and
but
so,
anyway.
Yeah, I was just thinking these disciples must have gone to bed at night wondering what was going to happen next. I mean, getting up must have been a real adventure.
Yeah, and I think some days, you know, three or four of them might have huddled and said, when are we going to draw a line on this sort of thing? You know, when are we going to tell Yeshua that enough of this is enough, that this is just pushing us too far, too fast, which is sometimes perhaps how we...
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we had a little freeze-up in the communications here. We'll see if Doug bounces back. There he is. Okay, so Jesus got out of the boat by himself, and then what?
Well, I just want to make an observation that at 5,000 feet, there's something else going on here. Mm-hmm. Everything that Jesus does redeems one of the six aspects of the three covenants. And in this case, he is redeeming the Abrahamic covenant, that Abraham's seed will be a blessing to all peoples. And it's time for these disciples to understand what all peoples means. It means every possible person who has a pulse rate.
Hmm.
And from a sociological perspective, these disciples are now looking at a naked, demon-possessed man living in tombs. If there's ever a sub-human being in their worldview, this is it. And part of what Jesus needs to teach these guys is God's heart beats incredibly for people who society views as sub-human beings. This is one of the lessons they have to learn and ultimately embrace. The gospel is for all peoples. And so this is a pretty radical experience here that they're having to live through, but Jesus has a point to it. God's heart beats for everyone, including this kind of person. And in fact, this person's fullness of time has come. That's a Pauline phrase. And he is going to be brought into the kingdom of God tonight. And that's going to shock you guys too. And So there is the negotiation. Well, let's back it up here a little bit. Be the demoniac for a moment. Okay. You may have been demon-possessed for 10 or 15 years. We just don't know how long, how old he is, and how long he's been possessed. We do know from Mark's record that he's got scabs and scars on all of his limbs. We know he has tremendous strength. He has broken forth from his chains many times. My own personal sense is that he's probably the most physically unattractive of any human being you could ever watch. He probably has rings of scar tissue on his legs and on his arms, some of which are still bleeding, some of which have become infected, and there's pus flowing out of them. He has no clothes on, and yet God's heart beats for this person. And so he's been tormented for a long time. Every time he gets close to the outskirts of town, they drive him away. They find him an embarrassment. They try to avoid him and shun him at all costs. He doesn't have a friend in the world. There's no one who cares about him. You know, someone once said, home is that place where when you show up, they have to take you in. That's not true for this guy. He's been ridiculed. He's been probably thrown stones at whenever he gets too near to people. He has been totally and utterly ostracized, alone, rejected, humiliated, abandoned for years, maybe even a decade. Okay? And so I have no idea what that does to the interior of a person, other than I'm sensed that the soul gets absolutely shriveled up. Furthermore, on the Richter scale of demonic possession, if there was scale was 0 to 10, this is a 13.5. When he says a legion of demons has possessed him, a legion is 4,800 in the Roman legion military sense of the word. Don't know whether that means exactly 4,800 demons are possessing him, but I do know that it means lots and lots of demons are possessing him. And there's this negotiation that takes place. And basically the demons immediately recognize who Jesus is. And they ask if they can be leave this scene from inhabiting this demoniac person and enter a vast herd of boars, actually, 2,000 of them. And Jesus permits them to do that. And they inhabit these 2,000 boars, and they run down a slope. Interestingly enough, from a geological formation, this is the only slope from the Golan Heights, which is a north-south geological formation. This is the only abutment that runs due west off the Golan Heights with a gentle slope down to the sea. I can actually take you there today. I can show you pictures of it. And these 2,000 boars... pigs is the word that's used in our Bibles, but boar is a more particularly accurate description, go running down these slopes and drown. What's fascinating about that is boars have a very wide girth, fat tummy, which gives them great buoyancy. Boars are known as excellent swimmers. The fact that any of them drown is remarkable, let alone 2,000. And then there's another piece of context here. Over on the other side of the lake where the Jews are, if you're a family that has 5 sheep, you're considered fairly well off. If you're a family, clan that has 15 sheep, you're considered fairly well off. If you're a village that has 100 sheep, you're considered fairly well off. 2,000 boars may well be 1/3 of the total agricultural gross national product of the region of the Gergesenes. Hmm. That's what got destroyed here. And there's a lesson here for us. The wind, which was hijacked by Satan to try to blow Jesus and the disciples off course to keep them from invading his territory, plan A didn't work. But guess what? He's got plan B. And plan B is to ruin the local economy so that the people will be so angry they'll force Jesus to leave. And there's a real lesson here for us. If you go on the offensive for Jesus, watch out for a demonic wind, and if you survive that, don't relax. There's usually a plan B that's still coming your way, the demonic invasion of a herd of boars. So anyway, that's what happens. And Luke in his record tells us here that the demoniac, when the people come out from the city to see what's happened, because the herds keepers went in and told them what happened, and they came out to see for themselves, they saw the demoniac, a person that they knew, talk about before and after, sitting at the feet of Jesus, and in Luke's record, fully clothed. Now, sitting at the feet of Jesus is the posture of a disciple. And what's fascinating here is, where did the clothes come from? I can guarantee you there's not an armoire of clothes in one of these caves just waiting for this day. Okay? So another miracle inside a miracle here. And there's also something else that's really interesting. This is probably a prophetic passage as well, because the Roman 10th Legion, which is the legion occupying Judea and Galilee at this moment in time, has as their mascot the boar.
Interesting.
And so you can sort of look at this and say, this is Jesus prophetically saying the Roman Empire is going to come to an end one day. And anyway, the people come out, and you think they would be amazed. You think they would be full of praise, full of gratitude, full of thanks. Wow, look at this person who once was a mess is now fully restored and in his right mind. Unbelievable. No, that didn't happen. They said, Jesus, get out of here. You just messed with our economy. You just destroyed 2,000 boars. I could care less that a demonic possessed person has been restored and rescued. That's not my value system. My value system is materialism, and you've just messed with it. Get out of here as fast as you can. Materialism really does have a grip on a lot of people. And it, to such an extent, it causes us not even to see the miracles of rescue and restoration that God performs around us in the lives of other people. Anyway, so Jesus says, okay, I'm going to get back in the boat. And of course, the rescued demoniac says, oh, no, no, let me go with you. And if you were the demoniac, wouldn't you want to be a Siamese twin attached to Jesus for the rest of your days? I want to tell you, yes, you do. And it seems kind of harsh at the moment, but Jesus says, no, you stay here. And you go back to the city, and you tell him what God has done for you. And in Luke's record, he says this man, whose name we'll never know until we get to glory, went back to the city and began to tell him everything that Jesus did, because for him, Jesus is God. And everyone knew his before story. All he had to do was tell his after story. Hey, remember me? A Jewish rabbi named Yeshua came over one night and rescued me, set me free. Hey, you going into the Roman temples, can I tell you my story? Hey, you guys going into the Roman baths, can I tell you my story? You guys going into that temple over there where they practice ritual prostitution, can I tell you my story? He just told his story. It wasn't a complicated story. Everybody knew the before, and he just told them how he was rescued in his now new persona. And Jesus returns to this territory several months later in Mark 8, and we have the feeding of the 4,000. This is the first missionary of the New Testament. A demoniac who's been rescued and restored, who simply told his story to whoever would listen. And several months later, at least 4,000 of the people who heard the story and were impressed enough came out to see this person who had set this demoniac free. I think what it does tell us is there's tremendous power in telling our story. We're the only people who can tell our story. We're the only people who know it well. We're the only people who know our own before and after details. And our story is far more powerful than perhaps we think. And rather than suppress our story or pretend we don't even have a story or go years and years and years without sharing our story, maybe this is a bit of a wake-up call that says there's power in our story of how Jesus came and first rescued us and ultimately restored us to sit at his feet as disciples of his.
You know, I've read Luke 8 and this story so many times, and I always go, that's nice. He rescued a demoniac. Okay, next chapter. I didn't know that was there.
Well, we're rapidly heading into spring, and blossoms are starting to open up here in the dogwoods and the redbuds. Where I am here in Maryland, the daffodils are almost gone. Mm-hmm. But let's say that each passage in Scripture is a rosebud. And our challenge, particularly in Western evangelicalism, is not to race from one rosebud to another too quickly, but to take one rosebud and stay with it for a while until it opens up and goes into full bloom. And that's what I suggest we just did with this passage. We paused long enough to allow it, the rosebud, to open up. And that's how I responded to your observation here. We should never be in a hurry to race through these passages to get from one rosebud to another. Slow down. Let the rosebud open up, and before you know it, you've got a whole bouquet in your presence.
Doug Greenwald is a senior teaching fellow and executive director of Preserving Bible Times, a ministry, again, based out in Columbia, Maryland, and they're in the business of reconstituting biblical context for us so that we can see the whole story, everything that's there. I would encourage you to visit their website, PreservingBibleTimes.org. You can link to it from our website if you're listening on BrokenRoadRadio.com this morning, just off to the right of the homepage. You'll see a Preserving Bible Times graphic. Click on that. It'll take you there. You'll be impressed with the resources that really are at your fingertips, a click away, that you can use for your church and your small groups and Bible studies and just for your individual study. And I would also encourage you to sign up for Doug's monthly news reflections, his newsletter. You look forward to getting those in your email every month. There's no charge, and it'll make your day every time you get one of those. Doug, thanks so much. Really appreciate what you've done for us today.
Thanks, guys.
Fascinating.
We'll see you next Wednesday.
Interesting.
Huh?
Carry on, and shalom, shalom.
Shalom to you.
Shalom, shalom.
Bye-bye.